at the same time tomorrow.
You're listening to BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now it's time for part three of William Golding, the man who wrote Lord of the Flies, our adaptation of the first authorised biography of the British writer. Today, the author's career and reputation take off when he's invited to work the American lecture circuit. The reader is Christian Rodzka.
In the 6 years after Lord of the Flies, Golding published three novels, all startlingly different. The Inheritors, which many consider his masterpiece, is about a group of Neanderthals destroyed by the coming of Homo sapiens. Pincher Martin is about a shipwrecked sailor marooned on a rock in mid-Atlantic. Freefall is a fictionalised version of his own growing up. They were all written in weekends, holidays, and lunch breaks while he was teaching at Bishop Wordsworth School, Salisbury, and they all sold well, but not outstandingly. What turned his life round was his stay in America in 1961-62. It lifted him out of stagnation and brought him fame, wealth, and the adulation of the young. It also spurred him to give up at last his hated teaching job and become a full-time writer. The idea of the American trip originated with Professor Lewis Rubin, head of the English department at Hollins, a small liberal arts college for women in Virginia. He wrote to Golding in June 1960, inviting him to come out as writer-in-residence for 2 semesters. A reply came by telegram on the 12th of June. Interested. Stop. Hope we can meet. Golding. Rubin offered to set up reading engagements to help fund a trip to California for the Goldings during their stay. But it was difficult. Golding, he found, had only a limited highbrow reputation in America, and his books were not easily available. This was soon to change. In the months before the Goldings left England, Lord of the Flies became, Rubin recalls, very much the rage among college students everywhere. Previously, Salinger's Catcher in the Rye had been the Bible of American teenagers. Now, Lord of the Flies overtook it. The reason was partly political. The Cold War was hotting up. Construction of the Berlin Wall began in August 1961, the month before the Goldings arrived in America. Lord of the Flies, with its account of nuclear nightmare and its anti-war message, addressed current anxieties. By comparison, Salinger's tale of a spoiled adolescent seemed irrelevant. Golding and his wife Anne made the crossing on the Queen Elizabeth. In his account of the voyage, he jokes about the strict class divisions on board and the comparative dullness of the middle class, to which he and Anne belong. When a gala night is proclaimed, a festival for the whole ship, Golding imagines the third-class passengers swilling Guinness and dancing knees up Mother Brown, and the film stars and tycoons in first class indulging in orgies and debauch. Meanwhile, the middle class, on sitting down to dinner, find that they've been issued with small paper hats. They put them on bashfully, avoiding all eye contact, and a confused British silence ensues, broken only by the steady champing of 400 sets of false teeth. After docking in New York, the Goldings took an overnight train to Roanoke, and Rubin, driving out to fetch them, found them next morning in the passenger terminal looking somewhat beleaguered. Though it was a warm September morning, Golding had his overcoat on. But Rubin was pleased at how quickly they adapted, and a letter Golding wrote to his editor at Faber's on the 1st of November brims with excitement about their new life. "We have learnt to drink bourbon, smoke cigarettes with filters, say, y'all, and accept an attitude which is surely as near as nothing to pernicious Anglophilia. We have so much time. 2 lectures a week on the modern British novel, hard going, and the rest of the time for writing. If it weren't for the parties, the mountain climbs, the trips to Williamsburg, the parties, the skyline drive, the parties, the local customs, the parties. But we've really settled down. He's scheduled to lecture at three other universities in the next 10 days, but admits he's rather vague about their location. At the moment, we just have an idea that we shall be in the top right-hand corner of America. The account of Hollins he sent home a month later is just as enthusiastic. It is an ineffably peaceful place, he says, lapped about by fields and set down in a fold of the Alleghenies. They've arrived in an Indian summer. Every leaf is loaded with cicadas. Eagles and buzzards float high in the hot air. Blue jays play in the fields, and a mockingbird balances on a fence by their window like a lady with a parasol on a tightrope. A mountain bear wandered into town the day they arrived, but was anaesthetised and taken home. The Hollins estate covers several hundred acres. The architecture is colonial, white pillars and porches, grouped round a grass quadrangle with splendid trees. Drifts of girls, pathetic and charming, giggling or absorbed, pass to and fro along the paths. Hollins students remember their surprise that Golding was on their campus. By autumn of 1961, he had become a literary superstar, and they suspected that if he had foreseen the enormous popularity of Lord of the Flies with American students, he might not have pitched up at Hollins at all. They could see he was in great demand and spent a lot of time lecturing at colleges all over the states. But he was not standoffish, and he joined in their student activities. It was a Hollins tradition that on Tinker Day in October, bells rang, classes closed, and the entire college climbed Tinker Mountain, part of the Blue Ridge Hills that nudged the campus. There were, as one student recalls, picnics, songs, and general silliness. When Golding arrived at the top in a bold knitted jumper, looking somewhat bemused, Professor Rubin, perched on a rock, tried to get the girls to sing Rule Britannia. Not with entire success. They enjoyed his classes, but quickly gathered he did not like teaching. They noticed he frequently looked at his watch, and when the bell rang, he shot out the door like a mad thing. He was more relaxed at the Wednesday evening creative writing classes in the Rubin's basement flat on Faculty Row, where students took it in turns to provide pretzels and beer and read and criticise manuscripts. At one of these, a student, Betsy Payne, was sketching him while he spoke, and he stopped in mid-sentence demanding to see her drawing. She wasn't too embarrassed because she thought it pretty good and handed it over. "So, that's how you see me," he said. "Santa Claus." After that, they became friends. Golding's daughter Judy remembers Betsy, whom she met a couple of years later when she was visiting England with her parents, as tall, leggy, and good-looking, with a splendid head of red-gold hair. She thinks her father was smitten. In fact, his journal records that he was still dreaming of the strangely glittering gold of Betsy's hair 10 years later. In December, he began another round of visiting lectures, and on the 10th he found himself waiting at a fog-bound New York airport, alone, he was travelling without Anne, for a flight to Los Angeles, where he was to give 3 lectures at the University of California. As he later wrote it up, this trip was a cultural helter-skelter, with jet lag so severe he felt his body and soul had come apart. It is his first ever flight, and they eventually take off at midnight. He sinks 2 bourbons before dinner and is flattered to be recognised by one of the air hostesses. He arrives, sleeps, wakes, is driven to the Santa Monica Mountains to see film star mansions raised by forest fires and swimming pools on stilts over a gorge, takes a look at the Pacific, lunches, learns that the university has its own police force and bus service, gives his first lecture, goes to a party where there are original beer-bone cartoons on the wall, sleeps, Wakes, is taken to see a Mormon temple, a colossal medical center, a beach. Gives his second lecture. Pleads for an evening in bed, but sneaks off to dine alone on a filet mignon and a bottle of Burgundy-type wine. Sleeps, wakes, is driven to see the San Gabriel Mountains with snow on them, and the Chinese theater, and the pavements with film stars' hands and footprints set in them, and Hollywood, and Mae West's hotel, and the William Andrews Clark Memorial Library, where, for 10 ridiculously exciting seconds, he holds the manuscript of The Importance of Being Earnest in his hands. Gives his third lecture. Goes to a faculty party. Is taken to an English-type restaurant where, to make him feel at home, the bartender and all the waiters are dressed in full hunting kit. Is rushed to the airport and flies back to New York. Towards the end of March, David, on vacation from Oxford, and Judy flew out to join their parents. Golding bought a Chevrolet that had belonged to an old lady and not clocked up many miles, and the day after the children's arrival, they set out westwards through the Texas Panhandle and on across the continent from Virginia to San Francisco. He lectured at Stanford University on the 3rd of April and the University of California at Berkeley on the 4th. It was while they were in San Francisco that William Golding Limited was formed. The first meeting of directors, Golding, Anne, David and Judy, took place in a Chinese restaurant. A rather consciously bohemian choice, Judy suspects, to offset her father's misgiving that he was joining the capitalists. From San Francisco, they drove across the Golden Gate Bridge and north to Seattle, where Golding lectured at the University of Washington. Then came another marathon drive across the Rockies and the Dakotas. This brought them to the University of Minnesota, where he talked on the 18th of April, and down to Chicago and across to Ohio for three more lectures. David and Judy flew home from Cleveland, but Golding and Anne headed for New York, then Lexington and Lafayette, Indiana, before returning to Hollins. It is hard to estimate how much ground they covered, but it was certainly not less than 6,500 miles, and they did it inside 5 weeks, fitting in 9 lecturing engagements on the way. Back in England, Golding received a letter from Putnam's, who'd published the paperback of Lord of the Flies, to say that the plates were literally worn out, so they had had to reset the whole book. Scores of colleges and high schools had placed orders for it for their survey of literature courses. According to some estimates, 500,000 copies had been sold by the end of 1962. The effect on Golding's finances was marked. "Your accounts department keeps sending us incredible quantities of money," he wrote to Faber and Faber. "I like it so much, and can only hope you keep it up." Sales of his other books also soared. The Spire, the novel he finished when he got home from Hollins, was published in April 1964. It sold 32,000 in America in little more than a month and topped the bestseller lists in England. Set in the Middle Ages, it is the story of Dean Jocelyn, who builds a spire on his cathedral, easily identifiable as the Spire of Salisbury, which Golding had seen every day from his classroom window at Bishop Wordsworth's. Jocelyn builds it to atone for his sinful love for a young woman. She has shining red hair, which perhaps recalled for Golding Betsy Payne's.
Personal disasters take their toll on the author, but his latest novel receives the ultimate accolade when Christian Rodzka reads the next part of William Golding, The Man Who Wrote Lord of the Flies, which was written and abridged by John Carey. And that's at the same time tomorrow.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock and welcome to 4 Extra, where we're about to indulge ourselves in an hour of great drama. And today, it's the concluding part of The Pilgrim's Progress. That's next. And then, how good is your nose? Mel Giedroyc will be discovering the power of a simple sniff as she explores how memories are inextricably linked to certain smells. That's in today's 4 o'clock show. So it's time for the final part of John Bunyan's The Pilgrim's Progress, the 17th century story of Christian, a pilgrim who undertakes a perilous journey to the celestial city.
John Bunyan, tinker of the town of Bedford, you were on the 12th day of the month of November in the year 1660, apprehended and taken into custody for preaching at an unlawful religious assembly, to the great disturbance and destruction of the good subjects of this kingdom, contrary to the laws of our sovereign lord the king. You will be sent to prison, and there remain until you will...